From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And we start this hour in Michigan, where the Secretary of State plans to send mail-in ballot applications to 7 million voters before the state's August primary and the general election in November. In response, President Trump tweeted a threat to withhold federal funding to the state because he says the mail-in ballots are illegal, although it's unclear which law he claims Michigan's Secretary of State is violating.
Well, meanwhile, parts of central Michigan are otherwise occupied. They are underwater after days of heavy rain caused two dams to breach yesterday. The Sanford and Edenville dams failed, forcing about 10,000 residents in Midland and surrounding townships to evacuate. Governor Gretchen Whitmer has declared a state of emergency. Here she is in a press conference yesterday.
This truly is a historic event that is playing out in the midst of another historic event. And so we need to make sure that we keep our wits about us and work on this together.
The Tittabawassee River is expected to crest at 38 feet. Midland's city manager calls this the equivalent of a 500-year flood event. Tracy Samilton of Michigan Radio is there. Tracy, what's the latest?
Hi, Robin. Well, the latest is the governor just finished an aerial tour of the area, and she says it's just devastating to see the damage from the flooding. We've got about, 10,000 people who had to be evacuated, and some of them are here at Midland High School. Some other high schools have been opened to take care of people who, you know, can't find relatives or friends to stay with. And as you mentioned, you know, the floodwaters haven't gotten their highest yet, so we still have flooding to come.
Well, as you say, you're at a high school where evacuated residents are sheltering, and the governor said people should continue to practice social distancing. So talk about this collision of pandemic and flooding. Is it possible for them to socially distance?
Almost everyone's wearing a mask. They have the cots set up at good distances, and everybody's being really quite careful. And it's really important because a lot of the people here are elderly folks, disabled folks, people in wheelchairs, and they know that they really need to keep these people safe. And so far, it actually looks like they're doing the very best they can.
Are you saying that they're on cots there? So are they keeping everything apart?
Yeah, they're more than 6 feet apart, most of the cots. Everybody pretty much is wearing face masks that I can see. And they're being really careful, especially because of the elderly folks who are here. And I think they're doing as good a job as they can at social distancing.
Well, meanwhile, what happened here? Because we know back in 2018, federal regulators revoked the hydropower generating license for the Edenville Dam, citing owner negligence and safety issues, including an inability to handle a major flood. So why wasn't that repaired?
Well, it's been tied up in litigation, apparently, with the state of Michigan. The company that was in charge of the dam said to the federal government, well, we can't fix things right now because we're trying to get permits from the state and they're slowing things down. And of course, it's been proved they weren't ready for a flood of this nature.
Yeah. And meanwhile, you know, the National Guard's helping out. What do people need?
Well, the National Guard has generally been doing evacuation. They're over at Dow Chemical because we've got some chemical storage ponds there that are commingling with floodwaters. So they're trying to help Dow Chemical. But most of the evacuations have already taken place. Here at the high school that I'm at, there has just been an incredible outpouring from the community, food pouring in, volunteers pouring in, and, these people are actually being taken care of really, really well.
And just briefly, we know there's been political tensions in your state, to put it mildly, protests, some armed, some ugly. The president tweeting support of protesters who were protesting against the governor's stay at home. Is all of that kind of taking a back seat to what's going on or what's happening?
You know, I don't think there are any protests scheduled for today, but we're talking about, protests that have been popping up in different parts of the state. They tend to be very small. Most people, when you look at the polls, support the governor's executive orders for social distancing and staying at home if at all possible. And so for the most part, these are not really large rallies.
Yeah. And now you have people who can't even get to their homes because of the water. So really tough times there in Michigan. Tracy Samilton.
Right.
Yeah. Tracy Samilton with Michigan Radio. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Let's head to Brazil now, where they're seeing a spike in the number of COVID-19 cases. The country has the third highest number of infections in the world after the U.S. and Russia. And yesterday, Brazil saw the highest daily death toll yet, more than 1,000 people. The BBC's South America correspondent, Katie Watson, is on Skype from Sao Paulo, Brazil. And Katie, Brazil has been a hotspot for the virus for some time, but the numbers just keep climbing. How are people responding to what's happening there?
At the moment, there's deep concern with where Brazil is on the curve. The testing here in Brazil is very low. The numbers keep rising. And at the same time, more and more people are relaxing social distancing measures. Mm. Authorities are trying to bring that under control. So it's a dangerous combination at a difficult time in Brazil.
Yeah, that was my next question for you. Is there a lockdown? What are the requirements for people to social distance, wear masks, those sort of things?
So it's now mandatory to wear masks. And the problem that we've seen in Brazil is there's no unified message from the top. We've got a Jair Bolsonaro, the president, who has on more than one occasion continually criticizing social distancing measures, tough lockdown measures, because each state is responsible for how they are dealing with the pandemic. So here in Sao Paulo, which is the wealthiest and most populous state, the governor has had the state under quarantine for nearly 2 months now. But there's not a tough lockdown measure. And in fact, the increasing criticism by some people, it's either to reopen the economy and go down the lines of Jair Bolsonaro, or it's actually bring in tougher lockdown measures because people are not taking it seriously enough. When the authorities are getting increasingly concerned about those measures needing to be tougher, that rules are being flouted, there's no unified response to coronavirus, and that's the part of the problem.
I want to ask you more about President Bolsonaro's downplaying of the risks of the virus. Of course, some see him as an ideological ally to our President Trump. What is he saying or doing as these numbers continue to rise?
Well, yeah, he has for a long time seen Donald Trump as his inspiration. I mean, he's nicknamed by some the Tropical Trump. He follows the line that social distancing is not the kind of the be all and end all. What he wants is the economy to get back up and running. He says that Brazil's poorest are the people who are going to be suffering the most because of the extended quarantine measures and lockdown measures, which mean that people cannot go about their daily business and bring money to a family, who needs to have food on the table every day. That's the concern he has. I've been to poorer areas in the last few weeks, favelas, where they would question that attitude. Yes, there are people who have to work, but it's about getting that support for the people who can't work. So more financial support, more government support. They're concerned. I was talking to one of the residents, the leaders there, who said that, every time Jair Bolsonaro comes out on television or is shown meeting crowds and disregarding social distancing measures, then the following day he's having to tell people in the favelas to get back off the streets. And it's sending this mixed message at a very difficult time, especially in poor neighborhoods where people cannot socially distance easily. There's a dangerous game being played. I think that's the biggest concern. And of course, we then had Jair Bolsonaro just last night say that he's going to ease restrictions on chloroquine to try and allow that for people who have mild COVID-19. So it certainly parallels with the US.
And you're talking about the hydroxychloroquine that our president has actually said that he is taking as a possible treatment, that is a treatment that is typically used for lupus patients. I want to also ask you about something else. So there in Sao Paulo, the BBC is reporting that earlier this week, hospitals there are close to collapse. It sounds like Brazil's healthcare system is really also struggling to cope.
the mayor of Sao Paulo City, which is the most populous city in the Southern Hemisphere, said that the intensive care beds were fast running out. He was talking around 90% occupancy in some areas. And it depends on where as well in Sao Paulo. There are very wealthy areas, but it's the poorer areas where we've seen the highest death rates, where the hospitals are the most overloaded.
That's the BBC South America correspondent Katie Watson in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Katie, thank you for this update.
Thanks.
Dentist offices in some states are reopening this week, but the experience of returning to the dentist's chair is anything but routine in the era of COVID-19. This week, the president of the New Jersey Dental Association warned that as many as 20% of the dentist's office in the state may have to close permanently. Across the country, dentist's offices that can reopen are doing everything they can to prevent the spread of the virus, from ultraviolet light to hydrogen peroxide rinses, in an effort to minimize the risk. Dr. Ramesh Nalia is a clinical professor of dentistry at the University of Michigan, and he joins us now to talk more about visiting the dentist during a pandemic. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you.
Doctor, we know how important dental services are to our overall health, but do you think now is the right time for a dentist's office to reopen?
I think now is a good time. I think that it was necessary, but for the last couple of months, we've been postponing routine care. And of course, that means that it's more likely that people will have urgent and emergency issues that need to be resolved.
How would you recommend dentists take on opening up their establishments as we enter these next phases of this pandemic? What changes to their workflow would you recommend, and some things that they need to consider as they think about opening?
So in terms of, you know, changes to workflows, there's a lot of products in dentistry that control aerosols. And before, that was a matter of comfort for the patient and the operator, and now I think we've got to look at those as a safety measure. The other thing that we need to do is integrate social distancing into the work that we do. And so, of course, the work that we do is very, very intimate, and so, you know, that can't really change. But we can change our waiting rooms and the way that we wait. Some dental offices are already having patients wait in their car, and of course, we will change our PPE. Our personal protective equipment has changed forever with this pandemic.
I understand what you're saying, Doctor, but some dental hygienists have said they're worried about the idea that aerosols or tiny droplets produced during many of these dental procedures could transmit the virus. How can dentists and hygienists be safe while also being so close to patients' mouths?
Yeah, so that specific concern for hygienists is relatively easily resolved in that there's more than one way to clean teeth. The modern way, using ultrasonic machines, does create a large spray and aerosol, but more traditional methods with hand instruments do not. And so there is an old-fashioned alternative that is equally as effective. So I think that working in closable areas or areas where there is filtration is the best thing. And also, there are many dental products that can help to control aerosol. The problem is that these measures will increase the cost of care for dental offices. Mm-hmm. And when cost of care goes up, this becomes an access to care issue.
Okay. Yeah, the president of the Chicago Dental Society said this week that many dentists in his area are struggling to find adequate personal protective equipment. Are you confident that there's enough PPE to go around with so many dentists reopening this week?
Well, there is a global shortage of personal protective equipment, as we all know, and hospitals are being prioritized for the limited PPE that is there, and rightly so. But this imbalance between demand and supply, although it will eventually resolve, it means that initially we need to focus on urgent and emergency cases. It might be a little while before we can transition to routine care and cosmetic dentistry and things of that nature. I think that for smaller offices, so I'm at the University of Michigan School of Dentistry, of course, and for smaller offices, in many ways, it may be easier to pivot and deliver care in this new era. For us, it's quite complicated. For example, before the pandemic, on an average day, we would see close to 1,000 patients. And now we have to think through how to space people out in our building, space people out within the clinics. So I think that smaller offices, I can't say for sure, but I think that they would have an easier time pivoting and being able to move into care delivery in this post-pandemic world.
You mentioned it might be some time before we see, of course, cosmetic dentistry and maybe the regular checkups that we typically have every few months. But can you talk a little bit about the importance of those regular checkups to our overall health? It's something that many people may not consider, but as we look at the long haul of this pandemic and sheltering in place and how our lives are changing, I just would like to know from you, we can't put it off for too long. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And thanks for raising that concern, Tonya, because, you know, sometimes dentistry is sort of the forgotten cousin of overall health, but oral health is intimately connected to overall systemic health. And when we compromise oral health, we're compromising overall health. And that's really important because, you know, sort of every year, more and more studies come out showing an association between systemic health conditions and oral health. And one concern for me is that a common response to budgetary constraints at the state level is to cut dental Medicaid. It's always one of the first things to be cut in a financial crisis. However, we can't afford to do that because of oral health's impact on overall health.
That's Ramesh Nalia, a clinical professor of dentistry at the University of Michigan. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Tonya.
Well, now a story about a different deadly and highly contagious virus that's spread across the western U.S. over the past few months and is having serious implications for another mammal population. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks reports.
A couple months ago, Ken Waldrop got a call that would alarm most people, but was totally normal for him.
I was actually contacted by Texas Wildlife Services about a rabbit die-off on Fort Bliss.
Waldrop works in El Paso for the Texas Department of State Health Services. He's a regional zoonosis control veterinarian, which means he studies wildlife diseases. He was told that about 30 wild rabbits were found dead at the El Paso Army Base. Waldrop received six of the rabbit carcasses, necropsied them, and then sent tissue samples to the Texas Veterinary Medical Diagnostic Lab. He was looking for two diseases in particular.
Tularemia, also known as rabbit fever, or plague.
Plague, as in bubonic plague. Those diseases do pop up in West Texas rabbits from time to time, and they can spread to humans. But it wasn't either of those. In fact, Waldrop wasn't sure what it was until a clue came from a neighboring state.
It was about this time that I found out that New Mexico Fish and Game had also experienced a rabbit die-off. They were the first ones to actually find the RHD.
Which stands for rabbit hemorrhagic disease. It's a virus that was first identified in China in the 1980s. Outbreaks there, as well as subsequent ones in Europe and Australia, have killed millions of wild and domestic rabbits. Shortly after Waldrop learned what it was,
then rabbits just seemed to start dying all over the place.
Waldrop started seeing dead jackrabbits and cottontails around El Paso. And he wasn't the only one.
The main thing that we've seen in El Paso is large numbers of dead wild jackrabbits. You might be out walking and then you come across a cluster of maybe three or four dead rabbits out there on your hike.
That's Mark Silpa. He's a veterinarian in El Paso. Silpa is getting a lot of questions about the virus, but he's not treating a lot of sick rabbits.
The first sign that most people notice is the dead rabbit. It's a fairly fast disease. If it's one of the ones that are going to die, likelihood is you're not going to be able to save it.
This is the first time Waldrop and Silpa have encountered the disease. It doesn't affect humans, but it has the capacity to decimate rabbit and hare populations. Before now, there have only been a few isolated cases in domestic rabbits in North America. But now it's here, and it's spreading among wild rabbits.
To sort of use an overused phrase, it's running rampant.
That's Matthew Gomper, head of the Fish, Wildlife, and Conservation Ecology Department at New Mexico State University. It's difficult to measure the rate and extent of the spread, but since March, there have been documented cases of rabbit hemorrhagic disease in northern Mexico, New Mexico, Texas, Arizona, Colorado, and Nevada.
And it's now in diverse rabbit species. So it's out there now. It's unlikely to go away anytime soon.
There are still a lot of questions about the outbreak, including how it started and whether it's wiping out entire local populations of rabbits or just a few here and there. Again, here's zoonosis veterinarian Ken Waldrop.
We're not sure where this thing came from. Yeah, how did it get here? Where did it come from? This one's kind of unprecedented.
There is a vaccine, but it hasn't been approved in the United States. Domestic rabbit breeders are working to import it, but that will take time and it will be expensive. Animal health officials recommend keeping pet rabbits inside as much as possible, regularly cleaning their cages and keeping them from eating local forage. For wild rabbits, that's obviously not possible, and vaccination isn't practical. For them, there's not much to do but watch for where it spreads next. For Here and Now, I'm Michael Marks.
We've been hearing about the death of the moll for years now, and in some places, they've actually already died. But for those that have clung on, the COVID-19 crisis could actually be that nail in the coffin. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad. He is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure at member station VPM. Hello, Robin.
Hi, Tanya.
So we've known the troubles for many years of those anchor stores like JCPenney and Sears, but now the list has grown. I mean, we're talking about Neiman Marcus and other stores like J. Crew, and these are big players that make up a lot of space in indoor and outdoor malls as we know them. How will these bankruptcies impact shopping malls, really, as we know them?
Well, as a father, I got to tell you, I feel for my son that he's completely been deprived of the pre-adolescent angst experience of getting dropped off at the mall and going to the record store and the food court and then saving a quarter or two for the arcade. You talk about these brands like JCPenney and Neiman Marcus. These are anchor tenants, the cornerstones of the American mall experience, and they're fading fast.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about that, but I want to ask you about these mall operators, which are basically landlords for these stores. They report that they've only collected a fraction of their rents in April. Many of them have their own debts to pay. I mean, how are these operators negotiating this?
Yeah, the mall owners, they're negotiating in a manner that tries to preserve the longevity of the lease. After all, you want the lifetime value of a tenant. So we've had a restaurant owner on my show who negotiated rent payments at the very end of his lease. Can you just tack them on to the end of the lease term? But then you have heavy hitters nationally like Starbucks coming out like straight up and saying, we need permanent concessions because the business has changed permanently. We're not operating a sit-down cafe. It's not as square foot intensive. So you need to give us back what was in those terms.
Simon Property Group, which is the largest mall operator in the country, they've already opened about 49 of its malls across the country. But one analyst said he thinks 90% of the malls actually won't be around in a year. Do you think that's right?
90%, I think, is draconian. But you are going to see a continued cycle of distress, or, you know, as you mentioned above, I can't pay my rent. So the mall as a whole is then strapped and has to fess up to its bank. And then the bank realizes it has too many of these on its balance sheet. And then you get the regional feds and regulators involved and everything. We haven't seen that yet because we're still kind of in the haze of the fog of war. But I think when some of this dust settles, you're going to see that systemically. You're going to see Wall Street, the real estate investment trust investors suddenly realize that this is a distressed sector. It's a sector in crisis.
Yeah. The National Retail Federation has been begging Congress for a bailout since so many Americans actually do work in the retail space, though. And some lawmakers have understandably, as you said, we're not actually too keen on propping up what looks like a dying industry. I guess the bigger question, though, is that do malls provide something in the way of jobs and retail spending that can't be replicated anywhere else?
I mean, in the throes of this pandemic, my neighborhood CVS unveiled 2 self-checkout lines. Still, I think it becomes everyone's problem when the majority of these millions of service workers, I think I saw a number like 16 million workers, they're furloughed or suddenly cut loose with a national unemployment rate approaching 20%. Again, that's when it becomes everybody's problem, and you can't just hold your nose and say, oh, well, that industry's dying anyway. We're all in this together right now. It is truly everybody's problem.
That's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure on member station VPM. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Tanya.
We've talked here about how the coronavirus and other emerging diseases get into human populations. We know that 3/4 of them are zoonotic. That means transmitted from animals. And in the case of the coronavirus, the consensus is it came from bats. But why is this happening in the first place? Well, the growing consensus there is that human destruction of pristine habitats is driving animals into new environments where they interact and breed dangerous new strains of viruses. This human trampling of the wild is what one scientist calls the promiscuous treatment of nature. Jonathan Watts is global environment editor at The Guardian. His recent article picked up on that phrase, promiscuous treatment of nature will lead to more pandemics. He joins us from London. And Jonathan, you know, what a great use of a word, promiscuous, reckless. It sounds like people behaving poorly in a nightclub or something.
I think that's exactly what it's like. It's basically rushing out, doing exactly what you want, not thinking of the consequences, not thinking of the partner, in this case, nature, who is suffering and whose suffering will in turn come back on you.
Well, the scientist was Alessandra Nava of the Biobank Research Center in the Brazilian Amazon. She said that we're treating nature promiscuously, but also that diseases were naturally diluted in the wild, but accelerated when this ecological balance is disrupted by man. You give Lyme disease as an example. Explain why this happens, what she meant.
Well, she'd done some research in the Mata Atlantica. Of course, we all know the Amazon. The other great forest is the Mata Atlantica. And there they found that there is a very prominent species. It's called the capybara. And the capybara was carrying Lyme disease and taking it into human populations. And what they found was that the capybara was much, much more likely to carry Lyme disease if it was near a human settlement. By contrast, the capybara in the wild hardly had any cases of Lyme disease. And if it was in an area of the wild that still had jaguars, then there were no cases of Lyme disease because the jaguars naturally kept the species at a sort of a stable level. So diseases are in the wild, but it's the humans that are increasing the risks of those diseases spreading out, mutating, and crossing over into a form that humans become vulnerable.
You give that example. Another is scientists who found viral prevalence at 9.3% in bats near deforested sites compared to 3.8% when they were found in pristine areas. Why do they have more of a viral load the closer they are to humans?
In the wild, these viruses have always existed. There are many of them out there, but they tend to be in a few species, and those species have evolved over time to live in certain habitats. So there isn't so much crossover between species that have evolved in different ways. But when mankind comes in, clears the forest for logging or for farmland, it disturbs this balance. So they're concentrated in a smaller and smaller area of what's left. Or they have the choice to migrate into human disturbed areas like suburbs, like farmlands, like orchards. And animals are mixing that shouldn't mix or didn't mix before. And as a result, there's all of this potential for zoonotic contagion. And generally speaking, bats are really major carriers of viruses. When they come into human areas, but there's no record of them transmitting a disease directly to humans. But we know that in at least three cases, bats have contaminated other animals, and those other intermediary animals have passed on the diseases to humans. So that was the 2002 case of SARS, another coronavirus, the 2012 case of MERS. And in each of these cases, these coronaviruses have gone from bats to an intermediary to humans. And it was predicted 2 years ago that the next big virus would emerge from bats in Asia and that there would be another one. And of course, that's exactly what's happened now.
Let's repeat that. That bears repeating because we hear a lot about, you know, who could have seen this coming? Well, two scientists predicted the emergence of a new coronavirus in bats 2 years ago. And tell us more just a bit about what they said, why they said it.
Well, I spoke to one of these scientists. His name is Roger Frutos. He's an infectious disease specialist. He wrote a paper specifically about the link between deforestation and the spread of viruses, particularly coronaviruses. And they made the connection between Southeast Asia and East Asia, which has the worst areas of deforestation in the world, and the emergence of diseases. They said it's very likely that the next big outbreak of a coronavirus jumping to humans would come from this region, would come from bats, and of course, they are exactly right.
Well, you mentioned Roger Frutos. He's getting ready to publish a new paper saying that if we want to prevent future pandemics, we need to recognize this human role. Is it as simple as saying, stop destroying pristine areas?
It's not quite that simple, but that is a factor. What he says is humans are, all of history have been converting land, and this will probably go on. But it's this front line where the risks are. And as economic development spreads into more and more parts of the forests in Africa, in South America, in Indonesia and places like this, that the monitoring and education at the local level is the absolute key so that you can catch diseases very early on. And that means not eradicating bats or necessarily even closing all wet markets. He said that's probably impractical and it will push everything underground.
Well, because you and others note, bats are also very helpful. It's not the bats that are the problem. And when you mention wet markets, you're talking about these markets in Asia where these live animals are sold. The consensus is that it was an animal from a wet market in Wuhan, China, that carried this virus from a bat to a human. But why not? Why not shut down wet markets?
His argument, it's unrealistic to close down all wet markets at markets where animals are slaughtered there or near there. Because they exist all over the world, a lot of people depend on them. The alternative is industrial farming, which also has immense health problems. And similarly, he said it's really mindless to argue that bats should be eradicated everywhere. They are very important for insect control. They're also very important for pollination. So it's very important to live with nature, not to replace nature. And it's important to note that these viruses and these animals have always been there and not been causing a problem. The problem really is human activity. And so what needs to be regulated is human activity on the front line. And he says, yes, it will be incredibly expensive to have monitoring and education in all of these remote parts of the world. But he said, look at the alternative. How much has this one virus, this one pandemic cost us?
And just to be clear, Jonathan, what would that monitoring look like?
Essentially, the keys are to have health monitoring centres spread throughout the developing world or areas that still have a lot of nature. And what you'd have is health monitoring stations that can provide early detection. And at the same time, you need an international network so that this information is passed on quickly. And then you would need monitoring of markets, the trade in food, much better regulation of forestry products, of everything to do with interaction with the wild.
One other note from Tierra Smiley Evans, who's an epidemiologist at the University of California. She finds threatened species are more likely to have viruses than animals at lower risk of habitat loss and hunting. In other words, yeah, the bat is strong, but a more stressed animal is more likely maybe to be vulnerable to viruses and therefore carry them to us. I mean, it just seems like such a cautionary reminder. Right now, vulnerable And in many cases, the more stressed out in the human species are more vulnerable to virus too.
Yes, I think it was a remarkable study that she carried out in Myanmar. You could also boil down her findings to the animals that are most threatened tend to be the ones that have fared the worst, rather, in their interactions with humanity, where they're likely to come in contact with bats, with pigs, with cows, with gold miners, with loggers. And yes, they're stressed for all of these reasons, just as we humans are stressed. And it was put very beautifully by Tierra Smiley Evans when she said that she hoped that one of the positive things that might emerge from the terrible suffering that we are going through right now is that people will realize that there is a connection between the health of nature and human well-being.
That's Jonathan Watts, global environment editor at The Guardian. His recent article titled "Promiscuous Treatment of Nature Will Cause More Pandemics." Jonathan, thank you so much for sharing some of what scientists told you with us.
I'm very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
And there's a new voice in mainstream comic strips. It's Christina Stewart, who goes by the name Steens. Steens is one of the few women of color creating a daily nationally syndicated comic. A few weeks ago, she took over the long-running Heart of the City comic strip about a middle school girl named Heart. And Steens joins us now from her home in St. Louis, Missouri. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. So Heart of the City had been drawn by Mark Tatuli since its start back in 1998. And your styles are very different. Maybe your outlook, too. He's a 50-something white guy. You're a 29-year-old black woman. Is this something that you've had to address, actually, in the comic strip?
So I don't know about directly in the comic strip, but I know when I first got the position, one of the first things I wanted to do was make sure that the life that surrounded Heart reflected the life that most people live. And that means making sure that the people around her are diverse. So I did add in a new character, Charlotte, who is a young black girl, to kind of, you know, let people know, like, this is where we're really going. You know, we're going to reflect the real world in this comic, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So the main character of Heart in the City is a white girl named Heart who lives in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. She wants to be a star, and actually she already thinks she is. Where do you want to take it? Your editor told you to actually push it.
Yeah, so they were looking to make sure that the story focused more on Heart and her friends in middle school. She's really kind of learning who she is as a person and understanding how to behave socially and figuring out relationships. And I think that that's something that I really want to address in the comics.
Wow. I mean, what a time. Middle school. That did you have to do some research or did you just hearken back when you were that age?
You know, a little bit is kind of going back to when I was that age, but a part of it is, you know, I have a younger sister and a younger brother. And so I was in high school while they were in middle school. So I kind of saw middle school happening again through their eyes. Mm-hmm. And then also the kind of cartoons that I grew up with, like Hey Arnold and Recess, like they're all about to be in middle school or already in middle school. And, you know, just kind of pulling on my interest in those kinds of stories.
Yeah. And what's happening to all of us in real life, really? So coronavirus has actually made it into Heart. Would you do a comic about other serious events that we're also dealing with in our culture?
So I think what I'm going to do is I'm trying to find a way to tell stories that are eternal, you know, because no matter what happens in our current events, you're always going to have to deal with, you know, my teachers are protesting for some certain reason, or, you know, I am not totally sure how I feel about, you know, this person that I like, you know? So I think those are the kinds of stories that I want to focus on and have it feel more like a, you know, a serialized drama than a commentary on the world.
Mm-hmm. You touched on this a little bit, but one comics expert praised the drama and specificity of your online comics. How do you create those things specifically in a comic strip? Give us an example of your process.
So what I like to do is I think about, well, what are some of the things that I think Hart would be doing at a certain point in time? So, for example, one of the stories coming up is about her wanting to get her ears pierced, which is something that you do when you're in middle school. But I also wanted to think about, well, what are some ways that I can make this humorous, but also new at the same time? You know, so not only is she seeing other people with earrings, but she's on YouTube. And she's seeing YouTube yeah. stars saying, you know, I just got my ears pierced so-and-so. And then once I have a piece of that story for one of the strips, then I have to figure out, okay, well, how do I make this a punchline? How do I make this funny?
I'm thinking back to when I was a little girl. I loved Brenda Starr. I guess that's, you know, I guess that would be obvious as someone who's a journalist. Yeah. But I just remember that very specifically. I thought she was just amazing. But what makes a comic strip great?
Gosh, you know, I think about the comics that I read when I was younger, and the ones that always stick out in my memory are ones that felt like I could relate to. So I really liked Jumpstart, and I liked Curtis because their families look like my families. But I also liked Kathy as well because, you know, I thought it was hilarious. So I think what makes a comic good is, you know, relatability, the ability to make you laugh or the ability to make you see something that, you know, you're not used to seeing. And I think that's one of the best parts of any kind of visual sequential storytelling is that you get to actually see it. And I think that once you see something like that, that's when it really starts to get into your own psyche, you know?
Steens, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. And thank you for having me.
That was Christina Steen Stewart, who draws the Heart of the City syndicated comic. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young, and I loved Brenda Starr, too. It's Here and Now.
Yeah.